Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Hello, genies. Glad you found us. It's Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com, where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, and we have a great show for you this week. First, in about 9 minutes, our attorney genealogist friend from New York, Adrian Benjamin Burke, is back to talk about Italian research, along with the pro he hired to actually go to Italy to extend his lines, Kathy Kirkpatrick. They'll undoubtedly have some great stories from the Italian trail for you, and great info if you're one of the millions of Americans with Italian ancestry looking for a breakthrough. Then later in the show, we'll have a guy on who's been researching his lines for years, teaches it, breathes it, studies it. That is, when he's not busy with his studies with the other kids in elementary school. I can't wait to introduce you to Hiram Veach. If you're looking for a way to interest your kids in family history, Hiram probably has some ideas. And Tom Perry, our preservation authority, will answer some more listener questions about making sure you don't lose your treasures of the past. Those of you who follow us on Facebook already know that we've just released 2 new apps so you can listen to our past shows in podcast form on your mobile devices. There's one for both iPhone and Android. Just download them for free from your phone store. Our online poll this week had to do with politicians. Do you have any in your background? We gave you the choice of yes, president, yes, congressperson, yes, other office, or no, thank goodness. And our number one answer was no, thank goodness, at 43%, followed by yes, other office at 36%, yes, congressperson at 18%, and yes, president at 3%. Thank you for your votes. This week, we simply ask, is there a family Bible in your family? Yes or no? Vote now at ExtremeGenes.com. We'll give you the results next week. Our family histoire news today begins with a reunion. It's the longest awaited twins reunion ever known. According to Guinness, 78 years for twin sisters to find each other and have their first meeting. Ann Hunt and Elizabeth Hamill were born in England in 1936 to an unwed domestic cook named Alice. Because Elizabeth had curvature of the spine, Alice felt she would not be adoptable, so she kept her and gave up Anne to a local family in Aldershot, England. Elizabeth grew up knowing she was a twin with a sister out there somewhere. Anne learned as a teen that she had been chosen, as her adoptive parents told her, but had no idea she had a sibling, yet alone a twin. Over the years, she and her daughter Samantha found an interest in family history. They obtained Anne's original birth certificate in 2001, the very year her birth mother, Alice, died. Samantha eventually tracked down a step-grandnephew to Alice who knew the history. He informed Samantha that her mother had a twin sister living in the United States, and he knew how to reach her. Last year, Samantha wrote to Elizabeth at her home in Albany, Oregon, which happens to be my own mother's hometown. Elizabeth was on the phone to England immediately to an astonished and overwhelmed sister, Anne. Anne said she was over the moon. I couldn't speak because I realized I've got a sibling, a sister. I have Elizabeth. This past week, the two met for the first time in Fullerton, California, at the invitation of Dr. Nancy Segal, who has conducted a 2-day study of the pair, looking for similarities and differences in these twins, who had only seen each other previously as newborns in 1938. The reunion continues in Oregon with a gathering of over 80 friends and family members. Does it get any better than that? Next, some 30 years ago, a Pennsylvania woman named Loretta Button bought an abandoned storage unit in New Jersey. Among the items it contained was a tin box filled with old photos, letters, and memorabilia of an American GI in World War II. For years, Loretta tried to locate the family of a man named Fritz Ferone. Every time she moved, she'd make another attempt. It wasn't until the obituary of Fritz's widow Josephine popped up in a Google search in 2012 that she was able to finally make the connection. Fritz died in large part because of wounds sustained in tank warfare in 1965 at the age of 46. Loretta recently met with Fritz's son Fred to present the family treasures to him personally. Fred says reading the letters is like getting his dad back again almost a half century after his passing. Read all the details and see the pictures from these remarkable stories now at ExtremeGenes.com. Well, the last couple of weeks, we've been sharing with you some quickie family history stories from interviews with some celebrities I've had the chance to meet with recently. This week, it's actor Charles Fleischer, the voice of Roger Rabbit. And I would have never guessed what he had to say about his background. Check it out.
Gee, on my mother's side, there's a Wasserman, and Wasserman was related to the Wasserman blood test.
Okay.
And I, too, am a scientist. I have a patent on a golden ratio device, and I have a paper that's on the Cornell University website regarding a discovery I made concerning gamma ray bursts. Charles Fleischer, gamma ray bursts. Google it.
Really?
I mean, not lie.
Roger Rabbit? Who knew?
Exactly. And that when I present scientific papers, they say, what university are you with? And I go, well, I'm a voice of a cartoon rabbit. It's kind of like, get out of here! Get out of here!
All right, now, Roger Rabbit, tell me about your family history.
Well, Roger Rabbit is a cartoon, my friend. It's all imagination.
Right.
Take this man to the precinct of the lost wheel. Thank you very much.
Who would have thought? We'll have another one for you next week. And coming up next, if you have Italian ancestry, we'll have stories from your homeland and how to get your records from across the pond with researchers Adrian Benjamin Burke and Kathy Kirkpatrick. Makes me crave some good hot garlic bread just thinking about it. That's in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. And welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. Happy to welcome back to the show Adrian Benjamin Burke. He is an attorney and genealogist based in New York City. How are you, Adrian?
Good, Scott. Thank you very much.
Good to have you again. And we wanted to have you on the show again because we wanted to move in the direction, talk about Italian research, which you've been doing a little of lately. We have so many people in this country. The percentages are what?
Well, there's about at least 6% of the population is descended from an Italian ancestor, or about a little over 17 million people.
Okay, and it was right around the turn of the century. That's where we had the massive immigration about four decades.
Correct. Between about 1880 and 1920, over 4 million Italians immigrated to America.
Mm-hmm. And so most Italian Americans descend from that group, wouldn't you say?
Yes, and they were primarily from the poorer southern region, Calabria and Sicily. And my great-grandfather was one of those immigrants from the region of Palermo, which is that main city in Sicily, and he settled in Buffalo, New York.
Okay, now I am not of Italian background, and I've never done any Italian research. Have you gone and done this personally? And how far back can you go from here, and when do you need professional help?
Well, it's interesting because most of my genealogical focus has been on my mother's family, which was primarily colonial New England. However, because my paternal grandmother was 100% Sicilian, I was fortunate that as she's still alive, she knew where her parents were from in Sicily. She knew the names of the two villages, and she also knew all eight of her great grandparents. So I already had a little bit to go on, and I was able to follow up in New York records, death certificates, marriage records, to find a little bit more. But that's when I ran into the block, because everything else was back in Sicily.
Oh, those brick walls, yes.
Yes, it was a brick wall, because even though I am an Italian citizen and I've lived in Italy as a child, I knew nothing of Italian genealogy. I didn't know where to start. And so I did my research online and came across Kathy Kirkpatrick, who is a professional Italian researcher, and I gave her everything I knew about my family. And she went to work in the Family History Library and discovered an amazing amount of information on my family, thanks to her expertise in the records and the quality of the genealogical records that Sicily kept and that the LDS Church photographed.
Ah, and we have Kathy in the studio with us right now. She's from GenTracer.com. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
And you go to Italy quite often. I mean, you don't just research. You go there.
I do research in the microfilm here, but I also go to Italy to do work that can't be done anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. And that's got to be a different experience. Obviously, all the countries have unique cultures that require a certain understanding to navigate, yes?
It certainly does. And then you have to know where the records are being hidden.
Right. And then who's going to give them to you and how you're going to get them from them.
Exactly. Yes.
So let's talk about that. Adrian handed over his information to you and off you went to southern Italy.
Yes.
And tell us about some of the experiences you had over there.
Well, I was able to start by exhausting the microfilm records here. And that's births, marriages, and deaths in Sicily back to 1820. And before that, you have to go into the church records. So when I went to Sicily for Adrian, I headed for the church.
Okay. So we're talking Catholic church records
in
various villages, or are they centrally located? How does this work?
For most places, these churches are only in the parish. And for most little towns, that's okay because there's one main parish in the town and all the records are kept there. But it does mean going straight to the town. And in a way, that's a reflection of the civil records, because in Italy, the civil records are also kept town by town, and there is no centralized repository.
That's very helpful, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I guess in some ways.
If you know the town.
Yeah, if you know the town. Yeah. I'm thinking this through going, oh, wait a minute. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that's the hard part. Too many immigrants came to this country and hurried so fast to become American that they lost that information. And so I have clients contacting me saying, well, it's in Abruzzo. And so then we have to research in American records and maybe naturalization records and passenger arrivals to determine just which town that is so that we can actually get to the records for that family.
Adrian, did you ever go on a trip with Kathy?
Well, as a matter of fact, Scott, I took my mother to Italy last spring, and we were in Rome when Kathy and her lovely daughter, Chris, came to visit us. We had a very nice evening, and then we proceeded to go our separate ways. My mother and I flew to Palermo and went to Monte Maggiore, my great-grandfather's home village, and we had a guide, and we went into a little coffee shop to ask directions to the main church. And would you believe that the owner of this little coffee shop, his name was Franco Bisese, well, thanks to Kathy, one of my great-great-great-grandfathers was a Franco Bisese. So I told him, I said, you know, we're probably related. And I told him, you know, I was from America, and then my great-grandfather was born in Monte Maggiore and immigrated to Buffalo, New York. Told him that I was there just to see the village. Well, he called all his friends over. One of them was the mayor of the village. So I started to talk to him, and he asked me, well, what was your great-grandfather's name? And I told him, Carmelo Battaglia. And he said, well, you have to meet Giuseppe Battaglia. He's the only Battaglia left in the village. So he called him up on his cell phone, and this very nice man drives over. In the middle of the day, it turns out that he owns a large factory in Monte Maggiore that makes windows and doors woodworking. And it's ironic because not only is the last Battaglia alive in Monte Maggiore, but my great-grandfather, Carmelo, was also a builder. And he was one of seven generations of Battaglias who were master builders in Monte Maggiore. So we had a wonderful time. I introduced them to my mother. Now, my mother doesn't speak Italian. I do. So I had to translate. He invited me to his sister's house for coffee, and we had a lovely time. We probably visited with them for about an hour, and there were other descendants who were lining up. They wanted to invite us to their house.
Kind of a celebrity.
They were just so elated to have this American and his American mother come to this little village. And Monte Maggiore is just a village of 4,000 people in the mountainside. It's very hard to get to. There are only two roads, and we had to cross a small river to get to it. In our car, we almost didn't make it because the river was the level was high. So this distant cousin of mine, Giuseppe Battaglia, he gave me a gift of one of his woodworking sculptures. He has a small guest house that he rents out and invited me to stay there anytime I wanted. And we have actually been corresponding by mail ever since.
Isn't that fantastic?
I've had similar experiences for several of my clients, some of whom were with me and some of whom weren't. And that's so common to be talking to someone in this little town who knows someone who's connected to this family, and then they invite you home.
Isn't that great?
It's wonderful.
Now, in places like in Great Britain, you'll often run into ministers who will say, no, I don't want to share this information for whatever reason.
And that does happen in Italy, too. But my last trip last month, I visited five churches in five different towns, and I only got rejected by one priest. The others were helpful and friendly and gave me access to the records. And that percentage is pretty consistent with my experience over since 1997 when I made the first trip.
So maybe one in five gives you a problem?
Just about.
And what's their objection to you researching?
Well, they give different reasons. Sometimes it's the sacredness of the records. Sometimes it's privacy. Sometimes it's I don't have the time. There's several different reasons. And really, the time reason is probably the most legitimate one because there is a shortage of priests. And unless a priest is willing to delegate to a member of his congregation to oversee the work like happens in Adrian's parish in Montemaggiore Belsito, it's hard to get in because there's just not enough hours in the day for him to work with the parish and all the living people and things he has to do. And people who are dead don't rank as high.
Right. That would make sense. What stories about Adrian's ancestry did you find that you got excited about?
The most exciting one this last trip was that I was able to get into marriage book number one, which starts in 1603.
Wow.
And the earliest marriage I found in his family was 1613. And it gave me the names of the parents of the bride and groom. So really, we are back into the 1500s, which is just extraordinary.
It would seem that in most any European country.
Yes.
Obviously, if you got into some nobility or something like that, you might shoot back further. But you're about as far as you can go.
That is pretty much as far as it goes. The civil records in Europe pretty much start with Napoleon, which is one good point for Napoleon.
Was that
1806.
Okay.
For Italy. It's probably earlier in Germany and France. But in Italy, the earliest civil records are 1806, and that's in the way far north. And then in southern Italy, it's 1809. But the church records are what these civil records are based on because they give the name of the bride and the groom and the names of their parents and how old they are. Well, not the church records for how old they are, but what village they're from if it's a different village. And so those church records really go back to 1663. The Council of Trent said, you need to keep records, all the baptisms, all the marriages, all the deaths in your parish, so that you can keep track of who's who and who's doing what. But even before that, some churches were keeping records. The cathedral in Palermo has church records back to 1449.
Whoa.
Yeah.
We're talking pre-Columbus here.
Isn't that exciting?
Yeah, that is. Well, Adrian, it sounds like you got the right researcher for you.
Oh, yes, I've been very happy with Kathy. I mean, her research was extremely detailed. She's also very efficient and economical, which has allowed me to continue to have her keep going back to Italy year after year.
Well, congratulations to you both. Congrats to you, Adrian, on finding this amazing heritage on that one ancestor's side going back so far. Kathy, so nice to meet you. Thanks for coming by today from gentracer.com. And let us know.
Scott.
I'd love to go with you on your next trip. You're just going to have just hide in your suitcase because it sounds like a beautiful place to go. You picked the right place to be a specialist in.
Absolutely. I love it. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. And coming up in 5 minutes, he's an expert researcher. He teaches classes. Oh, and did I mention he's 12 years old? I'll introduce you to Hiram Veach next on Extreme Genes, Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. And welcome back to Extreme Genes, Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, the radio root sleuth. You know, we're always looking for new talent in this family history thing, and I think maybe we have found him. Hiram Veach is here in studio with us. Hiram's voice is a little high because of the fact that Hiram is only 12 years old. How long have you been doing family history now, Hiram?
I've been doing it since I was 7 or 8.
7 or 8 years old.
So
wow. What got you started?
Originally, it was my mom who got me started. She was always doing family history, and sometimes she shared with me some of the things she'd found.
Well, so you must have been impressed by a story or two. Do you have a favorite ancestor?
One of my favorites is my third great grandfather. David Van Hawk. He was born in Scotland and lived in Scotland and England. One of the things that impressed me about him was how brave he was. His first two wives died. His second wife died right after giving birth to her third child, living with three infants and toddlers. He was very courageous. He endured many hardships. All around, very impressive.
So what kind of research do you do?
What do you mean by that? Do you mean...
Well, do you work a lot with documents?
Yeah, I do. It's mainly with documents that I work with.
Okay. And so you've taken certain lines back.
Yep.
How far back have you gotten on there?
I've traced back to 1296. On others, 1415, 1600s.
Wow. And what countries?
Scotland and England mostly. I've traced back to about 1817 in Germany.
Boy, you're all over the place then. Have you traveled to some of these countries, Hiram?
I've been to England and Scotland.
Okay. So Mom and Dad took you there, and you got to see some of the places that you discovered.
Yeah.
Now, has your mom been a little impressed by your ability for this thing?
She's nodding, so I assume yes.
So what is the best story you've uncovered so far?
I think one of the most interesting that I've uncovered was probably on my mom's side. He was born in Scotland. He was a soccer player, and we found him in the 1911 census. And it was just a few days before what's the English equivalent to our Super Bowl, the FA Cup final. So
okay,
and it was actually the only year that his team won.
And he's your ancestor or a relative?
Or the cousin of the ancestor I actually just talked about.
Huh.
His name was Archibald Devine. We actually found a photo and all this information just, I think it was a day before the 100th anniversary of the game he was playing.
And so did you find a lot of information about that game and what his role was in it?
Yep, we found a YouTube video, I think, a signed autograph. We found
wow,
a program, replica.
So you're making copies of that, no doubt. Or are you bidding on it on eBay?
Yep.
You've done that too?
We've done that.
You know, there are a lot of people who don't realize eBay is a great place for family history stuff.
Yeah.
If you put in a lot of search terms to lead you in the right direction, I've done that myself.
Yep. On one line, there was actually a line of beaches that immigrated to, that went down from Scotland to England, and they were botanists. They sold plants, and there are actually a few of their catalogs on eBay.
And those are your ancestors?
Yep.
How has this affected your ability to learn history?
In many ways, it makes it more fun. Civil War, history especially.
You probably know a lot more than some of your teachers.
Maybe not more than, a little more than some of the students, maybe.
But a little more than the students?
Maybe, sometimes.
Have you ever corrected a teacher about what they taught in history?
Once or twice, yeah.
Okay. Have you wanted to do it a lot more?
I have, yeah.
Yeah. What happened when you corrected the teacher on their knowledge of history?
He gave me chocolate.
He gave you chocolate. So that's a thumbs up. That's
yeah.
Pretty cool. Have you actually trained some other kids on how to do this? Have they taken an interest because of yours?
Yes. One of my friends has gotten interested because of I invited him to Reach Tech a year or two ago.
When you were like 10?
When I was 11.
And how did the friend take to it? Has he gotten involved?
He has. He's found quite a bit.
Have you helped him?
I've helped him a little bit, yeah.
So how do you analyze your data when you get that? I mean, you must look at the census records. You must understand that one census is different from another. And had a lot of fun trying to figure out, do I have the right person and that type of thing? Because that's kind of advanced.
That's kind of fun.
Did you ever worry you found the wrong guy?
Yeah. The other day, I thought I found a wife for a brother of my ancestor. So I took it forward. I found him with the wife. I had him living with his parents in the 1850 census, and I took that one marriage back to 1850, and they were already married when the census was taken.
Uh-oh, so you had the wrong one.
Yeah.
Wow, but you disproved it, though. I mean, that's good, because, you know, that happens to everybody. You got to start and go, okay, I assume this is the right person, but let's go prove it or disprove it, right?
Yes.
So what are your favorite websites? You have places that you like to work with more than others?
My favorite's probably Ancestry.com. Family Search and Find My Past are close seconds, though.
And what kind of records are your favorites to look at?
Probably maybe military records or the records that reveal stories about the person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the stories, too. I mean, those are really the best. So do you have military records from these other countries, or are they American records?
They're American and English.
Well, what records have you found in the military? What's a good military story you found, Hiram?
There was one that was, his name was Russell Lance. He was from Georgia. He fought for the Confederacy. I found several POW records. Once he died, his pension record said that his wife wouldn't swear an oath saying that the tax records were complete because of her religious beliefs, but she would affirm them instead.
Ah. So have you written any histories yet, Hiram?
Not yet.
Okay, you're just gathering still.
Yeah.
Okay, but 5 years of gathering, you obviously have a lot of stuff.
I a little.
Yeah. Mom's nodding, yeah. So what else do you do in your life, Hiram? Do you play any video games?
Not really. I do golf and swim.
You play golf?
And I swim.
And you swim. I'm just wondering where you get time for it with all this research you're doing. Now, obviously, you can't drive yet, so does Mom drive you to research centers a lot?
Most of it's actually digitized and online.
Okay, so you usually just do it at home.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the most exciting experience you've had when people start to realize, I mean, you're probably one of the youngest researchers in the country right now, and in terms of a serious researcher. What's the most interesting opportunity that's come from that?
I've taught a neighborhood family history class.
Have you taught adults yet?
Yep, there were adults that came to the class.
And you taught Mom?
Not really, no.
Not yet.
My piano teacher as well, she hired me to do family history for a couple hours on
really?
In the summer.
Can I ask what you got for that?
I got about $30, 40 bucks.
$40 for how many hours of work?
I think about 4 hours.
Wow, that actually, it was a pretty good deal for her, I think. Well, congratulations, Hiram. This is exciting. So what are your goals? What's up ahead for you?
I'm not sure.
Have you lost any interest in this at all over time, or has it just grown?
It's always growing.
So what do you want to do? What kind of career do you think you want to have?
Probably one that's related to history in some way. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's a little early yet.
Yeah.
Well, that's exciting. Well, Hiram Veach, thank you for joining us today. This is really interesting stuff, and we look forward to great things from you in the future. What kind of records are you looking for so the powers that be will know that they got to get them digitized so you can find what you need?
Probably parish records.
Parish records in what country?
England, Scotland, and Germany.
And what era?
1500 to early 1800.
Okay, 300-year block. Okay, because they're listening. I know that. So, Hiram, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Amazing. And on the way in 3 minutes, a couple of your listener questions for Tom Perry, our preservation authority, and a couple of answers for you. Plus, at the end of the show, I've got an amazing World War II story I just discovered involving a friend of my parents from back in the day. You're going to want to hear this on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. And welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio. You have found us. Fisher here, the Radio Root Sleuth with Tom Perry. He's our preservation authority from TMCplace.com. Hi, Tom. Good to see you again.
Good to be here.
And we have questions. People have been writing to asktom@TMCplace.com. Let's get started. Nathan Holden. Tom, I've been hearing you on Extreme Genes and have a question. I have a fairly large DVD library that I'd like to put on portable hard drives or access without the disk. Do you know of a converter program that works well and is user-friendly and would allow me to access these without the disk? Is that clear as mud? Thanks for your help, Nate Holden.
Basically, what I would suggest, and we've talked about this before, there's a real good program out there called Cinematize, and you can buy it from newegg.com. That's www.newegg.com. They're really good people. There's like three different versions of Cinematize. So what I would suggest you do is go to their website, compare the three. You might find some whistles and bells and some of the higher models that you might want. You might find the basic version, which I believe is about $50. We'll do exactly everything that you need. I love Cinematize. We use it in our store. We have people that bring in DVDs that, you know, they lost the tapes, they lost the film. All they have left is a DVD, and they want to be able to edit it. And it's awesome because it will allow you to rip just about any DVD into either an AVI format or an MOV format. So most PC users are going to use AVIs. Most Mac, Apple users are going to use the MOVs. And so once you have an AVI or an MOV, you don't have to edit it. But that way, with programs such as QuickTime, you'll be able to play it. So I would go and rip all these DVDs to your hard drive and do them in either AVIs or MOVs. Now, one thing, too, you can go in and do other things and make them MP4s and such. But the nice thing about AVIs and MOVs, they're good to play on QuickTime, but they're also really good if you ever decide to go back and edit them. And a neat thing about Cinematize as well is if you have a DVD that's, say, 2 hours long, but there's really only 30 minutes of content you really care about, with Cinematize, you can rip out just that one part.
Wow.
So it makes it really fast and really convenient. There's a lot of shareware programs out there. A lot of people use a program called Handbrake, which is great. It's free. But it's really, really slow. You know, you kind of get what you pay for, and it's free. It's a wonderful program. But with Cinematize, it's really fast. If you use Handbrake, you'd have to rip the entire DVD, and it could take 8 hours. I tell people, set it up, go to work. When you get home from work, it's probably done ripping it.
All right. There you go, Nate. There's the answer to your question. Next up from Leah Nielsen. She said, Tom, I have a floppy disk that has about 60 pages of letters from my great-great-uncle from World War I that I typed up. Oh, that's got to be cool. Now I want to transfer them to a CD, but my floppy drive doesn't work. I should have done it years ago, but had lost the disk. My husband tried putting the floppy into a computer at his work, but of course it didn't recognize it. I've since heard that those are not good disks, and I'm scared I've lost all the info. Are you able to retrieve information from floppies? The thought of retyping those years of letters is frustrating. Can you help? Thanks, Leah.
You bet, Leah. That's a really good question. Usually the problem with floppy disks that aren't readable in another computer, well, first off, the floppy drive might be bad. So hopefully that's what it is. Another problem you can have with floppies is they're from a program that doesn't even exist anymore, so they're written in an architecture that no computer will read. So the best thing to do is find some place like us that can transfer it to a CD. Then once it's on a CD, you can put it in your computer. If it's a normal Word program or some kind of a data file or JPEG, some kind of photos, usually you can recover it. But a neat thing now with the advent of the internet is a lot of times on a PC or a Mac, if you double-click on the file and it can't find a way to open it, it will say, do you want me to search on the internet for a program that can open this? And quite often there's a program out there that will be able to open some of your old programs. So I would suggest you try this, get it on a CD or something that your computer will read, and make sure you're hooked up to the internet, and you should be able to find a way to open it.
All right. Great advice, Tom. Thanks so much. And of course, if you have a question, you can ask Tom at tmcplace.com. And Tom, we've been getting a lot of questions from listeners. I got one for you here. What is the best format to store files when you're doing hard drives and disks and cloud? We talked about Cloud One, Cloud Two, to assure that you're backed up everywhere else. What's the best format to use for these?
Okay, there's a couple different options. My first question to our listeners would be, what is your desired use for the file? So let's say, for instance, you want archival quality, but you don't have a whole lot of space. Maybe you're just doing the freebie ones on the cloud, so you don't have a whole lot of space and you don't have a Blu-ray burner. I would suggest going to MP4s because they are great quality and very small. In fact, when you download movies like Netflix, that's what they are. They're MP4s, so they're amazing quality, but they're major, major compressed too. So if all you're looking for is a way to archive them, but you're never going to edit them or do anything more with them, then I would definitely go with MP4s. That's the way to go. The next step would be, let's say you want archival quality, you have plenty of space on the cloud, and you have a Blu-ray burner,
right?
But yet you also want to be able to edit it as well. Then I would suggest if you're a PC user, make AVIs. If you're a Mac user, use MOVs.
That makes sense.
You know, and in my opinion, and most people I work with, MOVs are the best way to go because they're small, but they're major good quality. They're usually half the size of an AVI. The only drawback to them is most PCs won't play them. If you're really into, you want the very best and you don't care about that, you can also buy PowerDirector, which we talked about in the earlier segment, because PowerDirector will actually edit AVIs, MOVs, and MP4s on a PC, which is, you know, pretty extraordinary.
Wow.
And it's only a $50 program, so that's a great way to go. So you have tons of room. That's what I would suggest you do. And then basically the last way is if you want archival quality, but you have very small, limited space, and you want something that you can send to Aunt Ethel and play, you can send it to Margaret, you can send it to your kids, and they're not going to have compatibility problems, I would suggest going to something like QuickTime, which Apple developed, but QuickTime will also play on PCs. You can go to the Apple Store and download.
That's free, QuickTime. Isn't it?
Oh, it is. It's totally free.
Yeah.
And it's a great program. So if you save stuff as QuickTimes, you should be able to email them to people, put them on your Facebook page, put them on YouTube, all these different places, and they're totally compatible. They'll be able to use across a platform. And most programs that you buy today have the ability to burn a QuickTime or an MP4 and such as that. So that's why I would suggest QuickTime. They're very, very universal. And whether you take your computer with you or your hard drive with you and plug it in somebody else's computer, QuickTime's always going to be available to play just about anything.
Boy, there's just so much to know when it comes to storage, isn't there?
Oh, there is. There's tons of stuff out there. And people always call and write us, say, hey, this is a dumb question. There's no dumb questions out there. We just have different things we're interested in. So don't be scared to send us any question. We'll take anything on for you.
Yes, you will. And thanks, Tom. Before we call it a show, I have to share with you a story I found this past week. A family photo from a pool party back in 1970 brought to mind a friend of my parents whose name I'd struggled to remember for years. And it finally came the other night. Norb Gagin. And I remember he'd been some kind of government agent. So I did a quick search on him. This was from the Stars and Stripes, Saturday, February 21st, 1948. Norbert Gagin, ex-soldier, said yesterday in Varsity Magazine he broke into Oak Ridge in 1943 every day for a week and stole atom bomb papers each time. Using a gold badge he bought in a pawn shop to slip past guards, he stole documents, took pictures, prepared maps, compiled notes, asked questions, and wrote a report on Oak Ridge a half inch thick. Gagin was an Army Counterintelligence Corps agent. His job was to break into Oak Ridge to test security precautions, and he did it so often, the guards began to salute him. Unbelievable. Sometimes we casually know some fascinating people and don't even know it. Thanks for listening. Hey, if you think of it, please give us a like on Facebook and catch our past shows in podcast forms on iTunes and iHeartRadio. And download our new free podcast apps for Android and iPhones. Talk to you next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family. This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel. Brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.